As everyone is aware, today is the 41st anniversary of the beginning of the hunger strikes in Longkesh. I'm glad to introduce our guest speaker today, Ciarán McDavy. Ciarán, thanks very much for coming along.
Thanks for the invitation.
Could you just tell us maybe a bit of your early life? You grew up in Belfast in the 60s and 70s, is that correct?
Yeah, I don't like to admit it too much, but I was born in the 50s. I was doing the car insurance today, and it's a very depressing moment, you know, when you have the date of birth and, you know, the drop-down list comes, and you just keep going down to the 1950s. But yeah, born in 1959, in August 1959, which means I had my 10th birthday in August 1969 as a refugee in Dublin. As part of what was at the time the largest movement of a civilian population in Western Europe since the Second World War. And I remember myself and my brother, who was 3 years younger than me, one sister was in the Gaeltacht. We were down with some cousins and we stayed with these people up near the airport in Dublin. And strangely enough, the brother of the chap who we were staying with was De Valera's driver. And we actually got a spin round Dublin in the presidential limousine. I don't know what it was, I saw something once and it gave me a flashback to it. But we were down there, and to us at the time, it seemed like a holiday. And one of our biggest questions was, like, we'd hoped that the thing would go on before into September, so we'd miss a bit of school. Mm. And we weren't so aware of the fact that we were down as refugees. And when we were driving down, I remember the roads were full of cars with kids. And the adults were talking about, there's refugees. And I remember thinking, God, it must be awful. It must be awful to be one of those refugees. Yeah. Without really realising that was us. But in the back of your head, you knew what was going on at home. You knew it. You knew that Belfast was being attacked, or that the districts were being attacked. You knew Bombay Street was burnt. And you knew that, in your head, you didn't know what you were going to be going home to. You didn't know. Would you still have a Belfast to go back to? Would you still, there was that fear there. The people in Dublin who we were with, I have to say, they brought us to places, and as I said, we got a spin in De Valera's car even. I say to my brother, he doesn't remember it as well as me, and I was telling De Valera, come down, rubbed his head, and he denies it. Like, I actually think it did happen. I was the notion of they all got, sir, here's the kids from Belfast. But it was a shock to your system, because then you see, when you'd left Belfast, it was still a fairly normal place, like the civil rights had been going on. But you arrived back to a city that had a soldier with a gun on every corner.
Yeah. I was going to say that. Do you think, what we call the Troubles, or did the politics of the time, did that define your childhood, or did you have, I suppose, an ordinary childhood in other senses,
You did, up until that moment. We actually grew up, people say, about whether Protestants or not. We grew up amongst Protestants, so we did. We grew up in the Protestant area. We were one of 10 Catholic families in a housing estate of 300. And it was we lived fairly normal existence up until that point. But then I remember you came back and, I was actually talking to a group of students about this recently. You came back then, I was 10, and You came back to a place that was tanks. The song goes, armoured cars and tanks and guns. That's exactly what it was. And there was in that time, from 10, I went to secondary school in 1971. And there was a series of very critical incidents that happened along that path then, that you had the false curfew then in 1970. You had the Battle of the Short Strand. In June 1970, which was the first time that the Provisional IRA made themselves known. They defended the Short Strand.
Yeah.
And very successfully, they did lose a couple of guys. And you had that, false curfew. Then you had the introduction of internment. You had the Ballymurphy Massacre. And then you had, in February 72, by this stage, I was in my first year in secondary school in Andersonstown, you had Bloody Sunday. And the way I put it to the students, I was talking, there were students from overseas and there were history students. And every time you talk about this, you kind of, you see a good little bit of added understanding to it, you know? Yeah. But, and it's the importance of Bloody Sunday, that that was the point of no return. Up until Bloody Sunday, if the Irish government had taken notice and said, no, this has to be turned around, this can't be. And if they'd gone to the American government, British government, friendly European governments, there was no EC at the time.
Would you be right in saying it was the point of no return?
No, that's what I'm saying. And from that moment, when Bloody Sunday happened, there was no going back. Because Bloody Sunday happened in 10 minutes. And it was a civil rights march. It wasn't a Republican march. It wasn't a Sinn Féin march. There really was no provisional Republican movement in Derry prior to Bloody Sunday, really. And that was the point when people said, what's the point? There's no point in doing these civil rights marches. We're just going to be attacked. We're just going to be shot off the road, beaten off the road, and there was no going back. And I watched the Ballymurphy. You see, when you're that age, 5 years is a long, long time. It seems like 50 years. But I remember watching the Ballymurphy programme and counting the years on and thinking to myself, yeah, that was Bloody Sunday then. 5 years after that, I was in H-blocks.
And it was around the time of internments.
Well, you had internment ended then. But, you know, when you looked at those, and it seemed like an awful long time back then, but 5 years later, I was in the blocks. That's the length of time. We have degree programs here that are that long. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that was the point of no return. And people have so much to say about all of this here, about many things, about the struggle in the north and about the conflict in the north, whatever way you want to put it. But that was the reality of it. And and with Bloody Sunday, there was no going back.
Yeah.
That was it because it bought Bloody Sunday. What the British said to us on Bloody Sunday was, no. This just says no. This is you can march up those roads till you're up to your knees, and at the minute you start being effective, we're going to shoot you. We're going to blow you off the road, and which is what they did.
So we're going to segue into some music there now. So next up, Dairg Dhún by Horselips. That was Dairg Dhún by Horselips on Radio Na Publicta. We are here joined today by Ciarán McDavie, our special guest. So the next question I'll ask, Ciarán, what was life like in the H-blocks? So you entered in 1977, is that right?
1977, yeah.
And your first impressions?
And now, while you were on remand in the Crumlin Road jail, you had your clothes. You didn't. It was after being sentenced, and I was on my own. So you were sentenced and then shipped up to the blocks the next day. And I remember I was 18 at this time. And a young 18. I wasn't, you know, I'd still a long way to go for it.
It's very young. When you think about it like that, you know, that's younger than I am now.
I had an awful moment. I have two sons. When each of them turned 18, I had an awful moment. I looked at them and I thought, my God, is that what I looked like? You know, is that what I was? But you went through nobody told you, okay, where's the moment coming when they take your clothes? How does that happen? Do they jump you? Do they rip them off you? And so the whole time you were walking through the place waiting for this, and it was actually just non-eventful. You know, we got there was other prisoners along with me, but they were wearing a uniform and they went their ways, and I was going off and I was thinking, all I just put it into my head, at some stage tonight you'll be sitting in the cell with with the rest of the guys. At this stage, I think this was just before the No Wash protest started. We would have had maybe 250 guys on the protest at this stage. Plus, of course, as well, we had the women in Armagh who, while they had the clothes, they were on the No Work protest, they were on the protest as well. And I took the clothes off and you're standing there thinking, feeling a bit exposed here. And the screw looked at me and he just says, put the towel around you. He says, put the towel around you. And I thought, right. And I remember going up and lunchtime, everybody would have been asleep and it was just around lunchtime. And I entered this wing and the cell was 23. I remember going in and there was deadly silence in the place because everybody was dosing, everybody was having a doze at lunchtime. And your man opened the door and this guy was stamping, all hair and beard, with red hair, this guy from Derry called O'Hagan. And he came walking up and went past me. And I thought he was coming up to say, hello, welcome. And he walked right past me. And I thought, what's he doing? But he stuck his head to the door and shouted up, we have a new man here. And the place erupted. We used to use the pots for pissing in to bang the doors to celebrate stuff. And the next thing, this place just erupted. And I was starting going, what have I done here? Like, you know, but it was a way to welcome you. You know, and it was when somebody new came on, it was a tremendous celebration because it was a victory that we got somebody new on the protest. And the noise was horrendous, like, you know. And you felt, you know, here I am, I'm with my comrades, I've made it, you know, through whatever. And fortunately, in my case, other people didn't have it so easy. Depending on the screws who you were dealing with, someone would have been running gauntlets and that, but it was fairly easy, you know, easy, you know, relatively speaking.
And it must have been, you know, you were locked in your cells for a lot of the day. As you said, the conditions when the No Wash protest started and the blanket protest and all that, what did you do to keep your spirits up at a time like that?
Well, you know, it was 24/7. It wasn't a lot of day. It was all day, you know. And you were 24/7. It's very, I find it hard to even envisage that myself these days. 24/7, four years nearly. I was on the protest, and you went to Mass on Sunday. We agreed to wear the prison trousers just to go to Mass on Sunday, no boots, nothing, and one visit a month. We agreed to wear the uniform to go to the visits because we needed contact with the outside. We needed to get the words, you know, stuff out. But it was one of the noisiest places I've ever been in my life. There was all the stuff going on because the normal image of prison is that silence. But they had thrown every single sanction that they had at us. So there's no way they actually control us within the cells. So even if they come up and says, stop shouting, stop talking, there's nothing they could do. Do you know, we were down to the bare minimum, if you go in, that what a prisoner anywhere in the world is entitled to, which is very, very little. And we didn't even have that. It was 1 hour of exercise. We didn't have that. A Bible, that was it.
One of the things you were talking about just before we came inside the hub here was about the concerts, and I wasn't aware of. Do you mind talking a bit more in depth about the concerts inside the H-blocks?
Yeah, that guy O'Hagan, I'm an awful singer, right? I just can't sing.
I doubt that.
Yeah, I know, terrible. And that guy that I was in with, I wasn't with him for long, I was moved with another guy a couple of weeks later, but he did me an awful bad turn because he says, we always have a concert when somebody joins to celebrate, but it's a standing order that you have to sing, that he has to sing the first song. And it was a pure lie. But they said to me afterwards, I said, why'd you do that? And he says, because people would be shy and they want to sing. And I said, but I can't sing for nothing. And there was this song doing the rounds at the time called Paddy Riley, and I think I made an effort at that. But there would have been, like, once a week we'd have had a sing-song, and some of the guys were brilliant singers. And you'd had sing-song out the door, somebody would have called people up, they would have sang their songs, and you'd had a blend of, protest songs, Republican songs, and the songs that we had been listening to before on the radio. Lion Eyes was one of the big ones at the time by the Eagles when we went in. And they were great fun. Do you know, like they were actually great fun, but there was an awful lot of stuff went on in the evenings. You would have told stories, you would have had quizzes, deep debates, very deep debates, which is a feature of Republican prisoners, that deep debates, asking, what are we doing here, lads? Why are we here? Not content to know, not content to just accept it, but what are we doing here? Are we aware of what we're doing here? How can we move it on? And very, very deep debates around everything. And we questioned everything. We had a formal debate. Now and again, where you'd have two teams debating against each other. And the very first question that we did when we did a formal debate like that was, these prisoners are criminals and they're not entitled to political status. Mm. You know, like, people were ready to pull each other's heads off. It was a good job. There was 6 inches of concrete between us all. Yeah. But, and I was on the team arguing against us having political status. And I remember at one point, I said out the door, and what political status will these people give the other people? And the guy who was in the cell with me, I had to stop him and say, look, this is not real. He was coming at me, like, you know. But there was this stuff at dawn. And, you know, like I've always said to people, you know, you laughed and you cried as much as you did anywhere else in the world, you know.
It reminds me of, you know, we're obviously, today is 41 years since Bobby Sands started his hunger strike, but one of his more famous writings, he said that there's nothing in their whole imperial arsenal that can break the spirit of one Irishman who doesn't want to be broken, and that mm-hmm. certainly seems to be the experience with he. So one of the songs that you've chosen that was sang on those nights was Deportees.
Deportees is, and I kind of found it since. I'm one of the guys, it was his song, and there was one night in particular I remember that, you know, these crisp, icy, freezing cold nights, where sound will gather, and he sang it out the window. But then we heard from guys, we were in H4, the guys in H3 and H5 made comments to people out at the visits the next day. They said, we heard him singing that song last night.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic. And, you know, it was, and again, a political song, you know, from another part of the world, you know, where we were making a contact with other struggles and other people who were suffering, other prisoners.
Yeah. So this is going to be Deportees with Arlo Guthrie.
The crops are all in, the beaches are rotting.
Now, Ciarán, we're discussing there in between the song about an interesting anecdote you have about the living conditions inside the H-blocks, in particular, the cold you felt. Do you mind talking to us a bit more about that?
Yeah, it's a strange one. You see, when I went into the cell, at first, like, with the furniture, with the beds, with everything, but we really started systematically to break the whole thing up to where we were reduced to just mattresses on the floor with three blankets, a towel and a pot to piss in. And then we broke the windows, and then we discovered that the window frames could be pushed out. So we had left ourselves no windows, nothing. There was a pipe with heat in it. But that winter of 1970, it was cruel. It was really, really cruel. And there was snow, there was everything, and it was freezing. You know, it was really, really cold. The birds would have been flying into the cells to get in from the cold, but then they would just straight back out.
My God.
Straight back out again. But when other ones came in and joined it afterwards, we had this thing that we used to throw at them is, where were you in the winter of 78? And some people still do it, you know, if you're sitting and you'll come out with that. And it's built on something from the First World War in the trenches. I can't remember which one, you know, but it was a cruel winter as well. And I think most of us will still remember that there. Is that we used to say to the guys that maybe joined in 1979 and they were complaining about something here, where were you in the winter of 78? But it was cruel. Now, look, most of the time you managed, you know? But that particular winter was cruel, I have to say. It was awful.
Yeah. Because, you know, the question is talking more of a
Well, I suppose better than the mudge. I suppose we in really tabatach are wrench hushina, every hen be our jangy hen would e. August we rinting neon, a dolum e, you know, we on lilin, nervy status politulon, as we on the darna hoor. August V. Rintinion of Ijanogilger Skull, Nirudan be furtifa, a ham hosima jafolum de rare healer, agus sam be funch an wyogins and sagart chivy, which at the shach or donach and tahar fall more humble be in gilic or halig. So for kishno going oginair, ogs ASD. So we shan tawatach, ogs chinro de germs agoni, sheer janghini, ogs shin and tawatun and lishigoilic, ogs vishi tawta kirna doing and shin. Ach, vi rudi ellen shin, vi si mar valahogin le rudi a flay, nor vi ogs nero na bar jerry, ni mylaman fuckle shin, ostage defa, ach, nero furden and free soon, vi nero should non mudge a hishkinch, near hig should mudge, vi tirao am gihila grudini le goilga akak nero, so vi midge non lort edrin hien, as vi midge non rudi a flay. Agus rudi vi an thawatach nor hanigan style gokrish, trivan na gaelige. Agus price sheetsin near hatchin shishin law, right? Rudella hogsha rudi gan ditch le janu. Vi ag poncha wine an eishins narang an skihin in a room, vi bun rang, man rang, agus ard rang ogin. Agus vi chinner shul lin am loan. Si bagrahla emach da gam loan vi a couple of reclaig ogit, agus beidra kyan wine el. Setronona. Ogs hogsha rodig and ditch lejano. Kanyishin inchin bia. Ogs, I suppose magalt the heen. Ogs mar harle le kid war fard. Ogs, this nimrach o my, agniruma law. Has a good dolum to grutin on follum. Do you know dolum to ogsalan? You know, ta quig chem ear manskala ogum, anish doctorat, moistrat, ta quig kin ogum. August, ta dini elkosle shin. But like, hossish shin in snitch blochen and there is higma. No, higla, and like, I know vima fus insis or skull, acne romajanogum ai. Acne higma, no, higlum fallum, higlum near wine could jiglum fallum. A heglum fallum, a heglum fallum gamai, August Hassim Mavunu, you know, Mahil Marvun chore. Shouldn't that your Hassim Mishavunu, Nurima Opne in the jig?
Old Skull Nakesha Fada, Mary Director.
Old Skull Nakesha Fada, August Ni Mission Tien Den Wine, you know, at the Kylie Higgajian level shin, Akar Hassishis Dien Shin, Gerhig Mudge, yeah, Masfajulum, Changa El Olam, Changa Hukasta. Who Jeffrey Shin at Allum, Neil Rodby, not Jiglum Allum. So Vishi Antawatak Ernard Shin, Agus Achmar Dirtma, Ogs Rod Jermsa, Agoni, Ogs May, Cancer, Gaelic, Sheer Jangahini. Shin Rod Tawati, Sheer Jangahini.
Durak Aranella, Avia Gwivan Trasson, the Rishling, now, Hey Jude, Lesh the Beatles. So Ish Meet Lesh Inner Dusak and Son. I think we will scale a good Marielle and our own son. We got doing it.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better.
And that was Hey Jude by The Beatles on Radio Na Publicta. As mentioned at the beginning, today, 1st of March, is the 41st anniversary of the beginning of the hunger strikes of 1981. Ciarán, as someone who witnessed what happened in the H blocks, how did the no-wash protests lead into the hunger strikes in March?
Yeah, it was, you see, you have to, the years went by, do you know? And that's the only way I can describe it. And like at the stage that I joined it in April 1978, I think, yeah, some of the guys were already in well into their second year. The guys in H5, that was the first established block. And I said the years were going by. There was a lot of efforts made to resolve it. Cardinal O'Faith, during about 1980, had a long series of talks with the Secretary of State and seemed to be getting somewhere. The five demands were brought around. There was a massive campaign going on. They ended, and they but time was going on, and it was quite brutal. You know, there was a lot of kickings being given out. I remember that Hey Jude is we had the shift in Donegal. It was they focused on one wing. It was unfortunately it was my wing, 1 week, and just went at us. And I remember one of the guys sang Hey Jude. There was a moment there when all the heads were down, and the guy started singing Hey Jude out the door, and the whole wing joined in. And that's for every time I hear the song, I remember that, and it lifted the spirits. And it's why Hey Jude is, you know, it's always associated in my head with that time. But, you know, the guys were getting towards 5 years. I was 4 years on the protest, you know, by the time we got our clothes back. And the various efforts to resolve it, both with us and with Armagh, had failed. And it was decided then to go on the hunger strike, and this was the first hunger strike in towards the end of 1980. And the guys all went on it together. Seven guys went on it together. And it ended in a lot of confusion, that there was a document there from the British government that they reneged on. The idea of giving us our clothes, it turned out it was civilian-type clothes, but they would supply them. And it was just the whole thing ended in... It ended in a lot of confusion. But the first hunger strike had the full support of the whole Republican movement and everybody outside, because they knew. So really, by Christmas, this was starting to sink into us that we hadn't got our demands, and the British reckoned that the hunger strike had ended, and it's difficult to know. So it was just ended in confusion, and it started to be talking about having a second hunger strike, and this was shock. This was a massive shock, particularly outside, and that Bobby had decided right, but he said, I'm going on 2 weeks ahead of everybody. And then we'll do it staggered. We'll only have 4 men on at any one stage, and they'll be replaced, because we knew somebody was going to die. And, you know, there's an awful lot said about that in between the two hunger strikes. It was an awful time, so it was, because we knew, you know, there was a lot of efforts we were made to resolve it, but we knew it wasn't going to happen. You know, because if it had been dealing with anybody but Margaret Thatcher, possibly. But she wanted her pound of flesh for her and Eve. And in some of the stuff that's said about it, you know, there's accusations made towards the Republican movement on the outside that they bound those young men up to do everything. And I can tell you, everything from the outside came in and said, no, lads, you're not doing that. You're not going on the second hunger strike. Find an internal solution within the prison, but you cannot go on a second hunger strike. And we had statements read out from the Army Council. We can't order, and it's a principle within republicanism that you cannot order somebody to go on the hunger strike. That's mad. But the way it was put, it said, by the same token, we cannot order anybody not to. But we are telling you, we do not want this. And Sinn Féin were, we do not want this. The whole Republican movement, relatives, everybody was saying, lads, you can't do this. You can't do this. And the guys, we insisted, no, because we were at the end of our tether. Do you know, we were really at the end of our tether. This protest had been going on. And I know it was fine to talk about an internal solution within the prison, but we weren't going to lose. You know, we had invested too much into this. Like, by the time... I should have been out, do you know, by that stage. I got 8 years. I should have only done 4 years. Ended up, I did 6. But I should have been really on the way out. I should have been out of there in 1981. And we had all lost. By this stage, I had lost all the remission, and I was due to do 8 years. And other guys were the same. You know what I mean? We had invested a lot in this. And we weren't going to give in. We weren't going to lose. And this is where the lie is. You know, when people say that, you know, that was right up from the outside. Well, the pressure that came on from the outside, from Irish, American, everywhere, you're not serious thinking about doing this because people will die. They said, normally, and the statement that was sent in, they said, normally you go into this and you think this is going to be brinksmanship and it can go one way or the other. But they're saying at least one person's going to die. Nobody imagined 10 would die. But they said at least one. And it was only at the 11th hour really, on the night before, that another statement came in and says, well, and I remember it started, well, you're obviously determined to go ahead with this, so of course we will be supporting you. But it started with that, you're obviously determined to go ahead with this, so we will be supporting you. And it's always very important to get that message out, because at the time, and especially since then, there's this thing that's created, and I've heard it said, oh yeah, those young men were taken advantage of. And no, this was driven. And I remember the prison chaplain, just before Mickey Devine died, he came in, and he had been with Tom when Tom died, and he said it to us in the mass. He said, it's only dawned on me that you guys are driving this up until now. He was very anti-Republican, but he says, up until now, he says, I thought you were victims. He says, but I've just realised it is actually you that's doing this, and I'm appealing to you to stop. And no, it wasn't going to happen, do you know? And so part of the confusion when the first hunger strike ended, we were still on the No Wash protest, and it created a lot of confusion. So one of the decisions that was made as we hit the 1st of March was that the No Wash protest ended. And this it made a very strange, it makes a very strange memory, because on the one hand, the second hunger strike was starting, Bobby was going on, but the prison had cooperated with us and says, okay, end it. We'll cooperate with you. We'll put, you know, we'll get new blocks ready with furniture in them, get the stuff in for you to get showered. They made concessions in that we were allowed to get reading material in, but previous to this, we were only allowed Bibles. And we were allowed to get reading material in for the first time, newspapers and books. No radios, right? And an extra visit a month. So we had two visits a month, and they stopped the mirror search, which I think is evidence. You see, they said the mirror search was for security reasons, but I think, you know, it was just pure torture. The mirror search was sexual torture. And that's what I think. And it's only recently that I think any of us have begun to say this, you know, that we were tortured psychologically, physically, but that we were also tortured. Say we were sexually assaulted. The mirror search was gross. It was a sexual assault. And this sometimes three times a day. And they stopped the mirror search, which is proof that, yes, that was punitive. Because when we stopped the No Wash protest, they stopped the mirror search, which means, yeah, that was punitive. If for anything, during the hunger strike itself, there was more reason for this extra security, because we had more visits with everything, you know. But they stopped the mirror search. And so on one level, life got a bit better. Do you know, you were allowed to write letters out and get letters, and life kind of chilled a bit. You went out every day for your shower, you started shaving, getting haircuts. But on the other level, we knew, you know, the first weeks of a hunger strike are, you know, nothing, it takes a while before it starts to bite, you know. And so you knew that bad times were coming. So you did, but it was a good decision to end the No Wash protest, because it was almost as if, and probably was, that, you know, between us and the British government, we said, look, let's not muddy the water. This is going to be down to one thing, and it's only going to end one way. Either you give us the demands or people will be dead. Now, at the beginning, somebody else says, you know, 10 men are going to be dead here. You would not have said, you would have said, no, it'll not go to that. But it did, and could have gone beyond. There was one point that when Joe McDonnell was coming near the danger zone, you know, that there was a massive effort to resolve it, and it was almost resolved, but what happened was that Joe deteriorated very, very quickly, and then the British stood back, because there was nobody else in immediate danger. So the British stood back and says, okay, let's just let this play out over the summer. And so just, as I said, it just went from bad to worse. And it was like Joe's brother, by the way, was in the cell next to me. And that's how we knew Joe had died, that we heard the door opening in the morning and closing. And I realised Frankie, myself and the guy that was in the cell, I said, do you hear that? And he said, yeah. I said, Joe must be gone. And we could hear him, the two of them talking in the cell quietly. And everybody was sitting, and then the guy in the cell with him, a guy called John Goff, called me up to the window and says, listen, would you tell the rest of the lads that Joe's gone? And we just put it out the door. And it was always a very somber moment, you know. We had the radio there, but I remember, again, the Bobby's nickname, when we were shouting it in Irish, so that Scrooge didn't know. See, we couldn't let the Scrooge know that we were getting the news. Do you know what I mean? Because then they'd know we had a radio smuggled in. So Bobby would say rhubarb. And I remember that morning, then the guy shouted, "Four rhubarb, boss." And we knew, God, this is going, this is getting seriously now. And yeah, that, so, but as I said, it came to an end. As things always do, maybe not the end that we would have liked it to have come to, but we got our clothes. We got half of our demands. We got our own clothes, and getting our own clothes got us out of the cells. And what that did, there was so many of us, that gives the power to really, over the next year or two, to get the rest of the demands, to put the prison in the position where it couldn't function without giving us the rest of the demands. The escape actually was the one that did away with the prison work. That once they escaped, because they knew, keep them just in their blocks. Don't let them see what the outside of the prison, the outside of the blocks looks like. And there'd be no more escapes. And, you know, I got out then in autumn, 1977. I came home autumn 83. And I went back to school, you know. I had promised myself that I'd go back to school. And it was a good decision. You know, it was a good decision, and it was something that a lot of us did. I was in the department, the Irish department in Coleraine then, and Tom McElwee's brother Benedict, who had been in the cell next to me, we shared a house, and there were quite a few ex-prisoners in that department. At one stage we wanted to go to Belgium, and the head of the department said, can you two go and get us a way to go? And so we found to go to the Landbridge, you know, take the ferry over. And we started explaining it to him, and he put his head in his hands and says, he says, for God's sake, he said, half the department will be arrested as soon as we land in Stranraer. And he says, you two idiots will be the first two. So, like, it's, yeah, but as it says, it ended, move forward, but you carry it with you all your life.
Yeah, and like, you know, our generation, we can read about this and we can watch it on the TV and we can... you know, do all those things, but when you actually hear it firsthand, it becomes very real. And it's not that long ago. No. You know, I heard someone say recently that if Bobby Sands and the others were alive today, they'd be in their mid-60s, like, yeah. You know, yeah. Yeah. Like yourself. So yeah. It's really not that long ago. We said we'd play one last song, and then we'll say it's long before after that. This is, I think it's probably one of the definitive songs, anyway, of this whole period. It encapsulates a lot of Ireland's colonial experience throughout the centuries, but particularly during this time. It was written by Francis Brawley. It's the H Block song, and sang by Terry O'Neill.
Sorry.
I am a proud young Irish man. My life began the happy boy, the green fields run, and I kept on a man's voice. But when my age was burning ten, my country's wrongs were told. My time.
strife of cruel loss, injustice rife, and I sought a will. My own young life, the fruits of foreign sway. Protesters threaten tortured men, visions nurtured, passions flamed out, rage provoked, rights cause defend. This is the conqueror's way. A Briton, mine from Ireland's banks, its 100 years prime. Descendants of proud Colclavan, Concannon serfs, cruel Britons on mountains. A scorned of justice well. No strangers are these bolts and locks, no news I, these dark hit blocks, cruel from well lives. Why Thatcher talks, should the police be tongued or bridged? Britain need 1,000 years of protest, riots, death, and tears. Rule alas, the kid of fears of any decade swell. On into Ireland's agony, scrim its blood sound. So I wear no conviction of form, nor meekly serve my time. A Briton might from Ireland's spite, it's on.
So, Cruinseach an Críoch, Le Clárin Leonov, that was Terry O'Neill singing the H-Block song. Very powerful lines there. So I'll wear no convict's uniform, nor meekly serve my time, that Britain might brand Ireland's fight 800 years of crime. So, Gur Míle Mahagat, a Cúrán, as Tachtas Lachanov, agus Lárat Leng.
Gur Mahagat, Ian, and, you know, for myself, and I think for all of our guys, to have a young generation who still come and talk to us about it is we owe you it. We're grateful to you too.
Mm-hmm. It might be 41 years on now, but it's still happening, closer than ever. So be giling a reached on Vortch Cooing on a Dogadina's 3 o'clock, Radio na Poblachta.